welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. An author talk with Bill Strever, hosted by the Anchorage Museum. Recorded on November 11th in Anchorage, author Bill Strever presents All Things Cold, a celebration of low temperatures. Next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans, after the news.
Everyone. Thank you all for coming tonight. I'm Mark Weber, manager and book buyer for the Anchorage Museum Shop. It's my pleasure to welcome Bill Strever to discuss his book, Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. Dr. Strever began his life working as a diver in the harbors and oil fields of Maine, the Gulf of Mexico, and the South China Sea. He finally received his PhD from the University of Florida and worked for a while in Australia. He now runs an applied research program in the North Slope oil fields. He has authored or co-authored over 50 technical publications on topics ranging from plant competition to the evolution of cave organisms to environmental economics. He also has written a couple creative nonfiction books. He lives with his son and his partner and his dog here in Anchorage. Join us for a book signing outside the auditorium after the talk. Please join me in welcoming Bill Strever.
Well, thanks everyone for coming and thanks for having me. And I'm here today to talk about my book. And I guess the first thing I'd like to say is this book has been really a surprising, life-changing experience for me. I've been a writer really all my adult life, and like most writers, not very successful. And then this book comes out, and I sort of thought that it would do what most books do, which is sell, you know, a few hundred to a few thousand copies and be largely forgotten pretty quickly. And instead, right out of the starting blocks, it was picked up by the New York Times and a front cover review in the New York Times by Mary Roach that was very flattering. Followed by a whole string of reviews in different newspapers and magazines, and The Economist of all places reviewed it, and just everyone, almost everyone that reviewed it had very nice things to say, very flattering things to say. And there I am sitting around here in Alaska scratching my head saying, wow, this is great. But what happened? Not really understanding what happened. So I wanted to share that with you just to let you know it's been a great experience, and I appreciate the support of people coming out and listening to me babble on about a subject that's so commonplace here in Anchorage. I appreciate your support, and I appreciate everybody thinking about the topic and about the book. So let's talk about the topic. Here's a nice landscape, something that we might see pretty soon, probably within the next month or so, somewhere close to Anchorage. And in fact, I think I took this picture not too far away from Anchorage. And you look at a landscape like this, and it's quiet outside, and we all know this experience. It's quiet, and the snow is sort of swallowing all the sound around us, and it's cold, and it's still. And in this particular case, it was quite cold. And it just feels like the landscape is kind of sterile. It feels like there's nothing going on here. But in fact, there's lots and lots and lots of things going on out there in the cold climate, and that's part of what I'm going to talk about tonight. And one of the things that's going on is insects. There's always insects up to something in the snow, under bark. In the ground, there's always things going on. And there's also insects that are inactive, insects that have super cooled and their bodies have actually dropped to temperatures well below zero and should be frozen. And in fact, if you just flick their bodies would freeze and they would die. And that's called a super cooled condition. And you can do that in your freezer too. You can take a bottle of water, and maybe you've done this before. You take a bottle of water and you put it in the freezer thinking, I'll get that out when it's a little bit colder and have a quick drink. And you leave it in just a little bit too long, and you take it out of the freezer and you open it, and when you open it, it freezes right in front of you. How many people have seen that happen? a few people were raising their hands. And that's super cooled water, so that water was in the freezer, and it was already well below 32 degrees Fahrenheit and should have been frozen, but it didn't freeze because it was very still. Nothing was triggering the crystallization of the ice. So until you pulled it out and you opened the bottle to kind of trigger it, to activate it, it didn't freeze. And you can try that on your own. You can just put bottles in the freezer and just leave them in for a little while, take them out and see if you can get them to super freeze. But the same thing can happen to these insects, some of which try to spend the winter in a super cooled but unfrozen state. Here's another strategy. This is the wood frog. How many people are familiar with the wood frog here in Alaska? You see them every summer. You hear them out in the ponds. They're great little guys. See lots of their tadpoles around as well. Many people know what these guys do in the winter. They freeze. So when I say they freeze, I don't mean they get freezing cold, like shivering cold. I mean they literally freeze. So their bodies are down underneath some leaves or underneath some rubble somewhere, and their bodies freeze. And if you find one and you pick it up in the winter, you can tap it on a rock or something, or maybe not a rock, that'd be sort of mean, but you can tap it on a log, and you'll hear it, its hard body hitting against the log, and you can put it back down, and you can come back later when it warms up, and you can see that frog gradually come back to life. And now, of course, you and I probably can't do that, and I have a slide later about that topic, but we probably can't do that because our bodies can't freeze. That would kill us. The ice crystals would kill us. But this frog has a strategy of pushing most of the water out of the inside of its cells. So inside of its cells become very salty. But outside of its cells, between its cells, there's lots of water, and it lets that water freeze. If the water inside the cells freeze, that would kill the frog. But the water between the cells can freeze, and the frog looks solid, looks frozen solid. In fact, is more or less frozen solid, and yet it thaws out in the summer and hops away. So that's a second strategy for sort of getting through the cold season. Here's the Arctic ground squirrel. We see these guys all the time up in the mountains around Anchorage. Everybody's seen these guys before. They stand on their back legs and they look around and they have fun. And this is an animal that I think of as the world champion hibernator. These animals are absolutely remarkable hibernators. And what they do is they crawl into burrows in the rocks, or they crawl into tunnels, and they let their body temperature start to drop. So no news here so far, right? This is a very common thing. Lots of animals that hibernate, they let their body temperature drop. But the ground squirrel lets its body drop and drop and drop and drop and drop. And it follows the air temperature right down, right down, right down, until it's down below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And you're probably saying to yourself, well, it's probably not freezing at 32 because it has some salts and things in its blood. But the body temperature keeps dropping. And in fact, it does drop to a super cooled state, where really it should be frozen, and it's not staying unfrozen because it's got salts in its blood. It's staying unfrozen because it's in a super cooled state. Its heartbeat is virtually indetectable. Its brain waves are virtually silent. So if you put it into a scanner and you look at its brain waves, nothing going on there. This animal appears to be dead. And then very suddenly, very spontaneously, at some point during the winter, it starts to shiver. It starts to warm up, and then it starts to shiver. Not in the springtime, not when it's time to break hibernation, but in the middle of winter, it starts to warm up, and then it starts to shiver, and its body temperature rises right back up, almost to its normal body temperature, which is similar to yours and mine. And it stays in that state for about a day. It's still asleep. It's not awake. It's still in this hibernation cycle, but its metabolism has increased. Its heart rate has increased. If you looked at it on a scanner and looked at its brain waves, now it's dreaming. So it's gone from having no brainwave action at all to now it's got this dream state, and it's gone into a dream state and it's dreaming. And then just as suddenly it starts to cool off again, and it cools right back off, cooler and cooler and cooler and cooler, cools right back off until it's down around the same temperature again, down below freezing temperature, and it stays in that condition for a while longer, and then it starts to warm up. And it goes through that cycle four or five times every winter, and then spring comes and it warms up and it stays warm, and this squirrel runs around, gathers up food, and hops about. But it spends the whole winter between this frozen state, virtually dead. Is that alive or dead? Who knows? The brain waves aren't detectable. The heart rate's not detectable. Nothing appears to be going on. And yet something triggers it to warm up. And something triggers it to start dreaming. And some people have speculated that the reason it warms up is, in fact, to dream, that it needs to dream in order to survive. I'm not sure why that would be. But so we can talk about different ways of tolerating cold temperatures. And one, of course, is hibernation. And we've been talking more or less about hibernation strategy so far. And this is a bird that hibernates. This is a poor will. It's the only bird that I know of, or I think that anybody knows of so far, that truly hibernates. It's in the southwestern U.S. And when it's in its hibernating state, you can pick it up, you can hold it. It's in a very low metabolic rate. You can detect its breathing if you try hard enough, but wouldn't normally. You can handle the bird, and then you can put it back down. And then spring comes around, it warms up, the food supply comes back, and this little guy flies away, and he's a hibernating bird. So that's one strategy for getting through the winter is hibernation. But another one that we all know about is migration. So lots of animals migrate, and of course the Arctic tern that we all see here in Alaska, world champion migrator, it migrates all the way from up in northern Alaska all the way to Antarctica and back every year, back and forth, a true world traveler. And it takes the strategy of migration, just like some humans do. And then these guys, of course, are ptarmigan. So we have hibernators that we've talked about, we have migrators, and now we have the third strategy, which is tolerators. So there's lots of animals out there that just sort of tolerate the cold conditions, and they feed, they burn lots of calories in the winter, and they get through the winter. So humans, of course, are mostly tolerators. To some degree, we're migrators, I suppose, when people fly south for the winter. And to some degree, some of us would like to be hibernators, but in fact, human beings are not that great at hibernating. So I wanted to have a slide of a few other tolerators just because it's such an amazing strategy. And of course, this is the muskox, and we see these guys up in northern Alaska and northern Canada. The warmest natural fiber in the world, and you'll see that advertised around Alaska when you buy very expensive scarves and hats and things, but it is true, the world's warmest natural fiber in the muskox. And every time I see these guys out in the wild, it always amazes me and makes me feel like I've gone back in time, back to the end of the Pleistocene and looking around the corner for a woolly mammoth or something, but just amazing animals. And more commonly, we see these guys, the moose. And the moose is so well adapted to the cold that when it's in its winter state, it will overheat if it runs too much, as will, by the way, the muskox. They really cannot afford to overheat when they're in their winter coat and they're winter adapted. And the same is true for moose. In fact, moose are so well adapted to the cold that they often won't even begin shivering until it's 10 or 20 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. So very well cold adapted during the cold season. And then these little guys, we talked earlier about the Arctic ground squirrel. This, of course, is a regular old tree squirrel in a tree outside my house here in Anchorage. And these guys are awake all winter. You've probably noticed that. And they're running around furiously feeding. They have food stashed all over the yard and various places and maybe even in your attic. And they need that food to get through the winter because they burn lots and lots of calories to stay warm with that tiny little body. Well, why don't they hibernate? Wouldn't it be easier for these guys to hibernate? Well, the problem with small animals, if they hibernate and they don't have some special adaptation like the Arctic ground squirrel, is that they'll lose too much heat out of their body too quickly, and before spring comes around, they would freeze and die. So they have to stay active and they have to continue to feed and et cetera. So what about human adaptations to cold? Lots of animals have great adaptations with fur and different ways that they metabolize food and things like that, but what about humans? Well, Charles Darwin, most people don't realize about Charles Darwin. He spent most of the time on the Beagle feeling rather miserable and seasick as he sailed around the world to different places. And he did not just spend all of his time in the Galapagos Islands looking at finches. He went to lots of other places. And one of those places was southern South America. And in southern South America, he encountered these people that seemed to be remarkably tolerant of the cold. And he didn't recognize that at first, and he wrote things about these people like this. While going one day on shore near Wollaston Island, we pulled alongside a canoe with six Fijians. These were the most abject and miserable creatures I anywhere beheld. And he wrote about another scene in which he encountered a woman and the woman's baby, and the woman was almost naked and holding this baby in her arms, and the baby was naked, and it was sleeting, and the sleet was dripping off this woman's back, and Darwin himself, of course, was quite cold. And he talked again about how miserable this person was. Well, it turns out that these people are genetically pre-adapted to, or genetically adapted to, very cold climates, to very cold conditions. So while Darwin was feeling quite cold himself, these people were quite warm. They have a different metabolism than other human beings, and that metabolism allowed them to stay much warmer when in fact it was cold to us mere mortals outside. And they're not the only group like that. There's been several groups around the world that have been identified that have these special adaptations to cold. One of those groups is the Ama divers of Japan and Korea. And nowadays it's probably not so true. It's certainly no longer true for the South American native people because of breeding, outbreeding with other populations. But it used to be true that they were adapted to cold, as was true of the Amadivers, that they were remarkably adapted to cold, especially the women. And the Amadiving was always almost always an activity for women. Occasionally men would do it, but in general, men just weren't tough enough for the very cold waters. And these women, even today, dive in waters that would leave me anyway, and probably most people in this room, would leave us unconscious after 2 or 3 hours, and yet they go in water like that every day, day after day after day, diving typically for seafood. And they don't wear wetsuits and they don't wear dry suits, and you ask yourself, well, why in the world don't they go out and buy a dry suit or something and make it easier for themselves? Well, they don't do that because they came to an agreement many, many, many decades ago. They recognized that if they use modern technology to harvest these seafoods, they would very quickly wipe out their source of income, wipe out their crop, by making it too easy to harvest the crop. So that they got together and formed agreements. And one of those agreements was that they would not wear anything more than just minimal thermal protection. And they continue to do that kind of thing to this day with breath hold diving. But humans aren't all that well adapted. One of the characters in the book, who I describe, I think, in the book as my companion, who is now my wife. I still describe her as my companion. And she's a wonderful person, but she has one fault, and that fault is that she suffers very badly from Raynaud's syndrome, or Raynaud's syndrome. Different people pronounce it differently. How many people in the room have Raynaud's or know somebody with severe Raynaud's? Okay. It's pretty inconvenient when you live in Alaska and you have Raynaud's. And what happens is that when you go outside and your part of your brain, your hypothalamus, says, hey, it's cold outside, or it recognizes that your core temperature is at threat of dropping, it overreacts, and it overreacts by cutting off circulation to your fingers and sometimes your toes. And all of a sudden, your fingers and toes start to look very much like you're frostbitten, or even in some cases like you're dead. And depending on how severe your syndrome is, depending on how severe it is, it can be debilitating while you're in the cold. And my wife, for example, can't operate zippers and things like that. So we have to be a bit careful when we're out doing our various adventures. It's harmless, though. She goes back to a warm area. It's painful as she warms up. In fact, sometimes very painful. But it doesn't get worse over time, and it doesn't lead to frostbite or anything like that. It's just very inconvenient and could be, in fact, dangerous if she was ever somewhere that she needed to work a zipper, or to work something that needed some fine motor skills that she just really does not have when she's in this condition. So there's some counter adaptations, but humans shouldn't feel alone in that, because even dogs and for that matter moose and all mammals have counter adaptations as well. And here you can see our poor dog Lucky. I don't know if you can see it very well in that picture, but he's looking very sad and pathetic because he has a bit of frostbite on his nose. And he got that on a fairly warm day. He's been out on colder days many times before and since with no problem. But on this particular day, he came back with a little bit of mild frostbite, and the skin peeled away and blistered and that kind of thing. And he had to wear this silly cone and wandered around the house bumping into everything while he healed and looking pathetic and getting all kinds of biscuits. I think he put on 5 pounds with these pathetic looks he had. But all mammals are subject to the possibility of frostbite. In fact, even ice seals that live up in the Arctic, and they live in the frozen, they live beneath the frozen Beaufort Sea. So during the winter, they're living underneath the ice, and they have air holes that they maintain with claws on their foreflippers. And they have pups that they give birth to in caves that they dig in the ice. And they're out in terrible, terrible conditions, and yet we find ice seals that are suffering from frostbite, especially when they're stranded, well, not especially, but when they're stranded above the ice where it's truly cold and they can't get down into the water because their holes have sealed up. They're subject to frostbite just like all other mammals are. And frostbite, I think this would be a good place to talk about frostbite. Frostbite, I think a lot of people have this confusion around frostbite and hypothermia. And I think hopefully not too many Alaskans are confused by that. But frostbite is when your limbs actually freeze, or parts of your tissue freeze. And it literally freezes. You get ice crystals that form in your skin and then in your deeper tissues if it's severe enough, and even right into your bones, which kills those tissues. So you lose those tissues that are frozen. That's true frostbite. And of course, most of us have experienced frost nip. It's not nearly as severe and you recover. But that's true frostbite. Hypothermia is a little different. Hypothermia is when our core temperature drops. And hypothermia can kill you. So frostbite generally will not kill you if you can get to some place to be treated. You might lose a finger or something, but generally won't kill you. But true hypothermia, where your core temperature drops, it can kill you. And you'll go through a series of symptoms. And unfortunately, the very first symptom is that your judgment starts to lapse. So your ability to think clearly starts to deteriorate. And then you go through things like the mumbles, people call it. You start mumbling because you can't work your jaw muscles very well anymore. And then you may start to grumble and complain. And then eventually you might stumble because you can't control your movement anymore. And then you're kind of down on the ground. And if somebody doesn't come along and help you, you're in deep, deep trouble. And that's hypothermia. So that's the dropping of your body's core temperature as opposed to just the dropping of the temperature in your extremities. And here's a photograph of me in infrared light. It's a great photograph, all my best features showing. With using infrared light, you can look at this and you can look at my parka and you can see all kinds of things like where the heat is leaking. And you'll notice a few things about the picture if you look closely. First of all, in the background, in the sky, it's black. And if you look at the temperature gauge on the right side, the black is the cold part of this photo. So the darker the color, the colder it is. And back there in the back, it was a minus 40 or minus 45 day. So the air is very cold. You can see that the snow is much warmer than the air, which is very typical. It's also typical for the snow to be even warmer underneath the surface of the snow. So if you dug down into the snow, you'd find it's even warmer below the surface. The other thing you can see is all the good leak spots on my parka. I had a mask on, so that's through a mask, and you can see even with a face mask on, you lose a tremendous amount of heat through your face. The hood's pulled back a little bit. But you can also see my boots, and those were good boots, but they were leaking a lot of heat. My gloves, which were very good mitts, are also losing a lot of heat, and it looks like the inseams on my sleeves were losing some heat. So something to check out if you use very cold water or very cold cold temperature equipment. You could take a look at it with an infrared scope and see where you're losing heat. And this is kind of the mid-talk intermission. I'm going to play a little video clip, and I get to take a break while this plays, and you guys can watch a video clip. I guess by way of background for this, soon after Cold came out, there was a company in New York that wanted to do a movie based on the book, and I was scratching my head about that because I had no idea how you could make a movie about Cold, but they wanted me to send them a little video clip. That company, maybe it was a sign of their judgment. They subsequently went out of business, so we never did make a movie. But in any case, I sent them this little homemade video clip to give them a sample. And it's kind of a fun clip, and I'll play it for you now. I think it goes about 2 minutes.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage with author Bill Strever. You can watch his video on how to build a Quinzy, also known as a snow hut, on kska.org. Strever's talk on All Things Cold, a Celebration of Low Temperatures, was recorded on November 11th at the Anchorage Museum.
So that's it. That's my Quinzy video. How many people have built a Quinzy? How many people have built a snow fort and didn't know it was called a Quinzy? At this part of the talk, I'm going to shift a little bit, and I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of human history in cold as opposed to adaptations and biology in cold. And I'm going to start with this little interesting piece of history. There was a book published in, I believe, if I remember right, it was in the 1970s called The Prospect of Immortality. Does anybody remember that book? It was a runaway bestseller published in 12 languages. Nobody remembers it anymore, do they? It's humbling to be an author. The Prospect of Immortality promoted this idea that you could freeze humans. It promoted the idea that you could take someone who was dead or dying or didn't care, and you could freeze them, and that sometime in the future, some brilliant person would figure out a technology to thaw these people out and bring them back to life and cure whatever's wrong with these people. And it started this field called cryonics, and it's still going on today. You can still, in fact, today in the United States, you can have your body frozen. You legally have to be dead first. You have to be declared, in the U.S., you have to be declared dead first. And then you would be immediately go through this process that the cryonics people have set up, and your body would be frozen and stored in perpetuity. And you pay up front to have your body stored in perpetuity or until someone comes along with some method of thawing you out. That service is available. It's surprisingly cheap. Immortality is surprisingly affordable these days. I think somewhere around $100,000, $150,000. And I believe there's even opportunities to set up life insurance to have your life insurance pay for this through some services in case anybody's interested. No promises that you're ever going to be thawed out from the author of Cold. I personally don't think it's possible. I think you're the cells are essentially 100% destroyed, and it's about as likely as creating a cow from a hamburger that you're ever going to bring a person out of a cryonic freezer. But nevertheless, people do it, and teach their own, and you know, diversity and inclusion and all those good things. People should do what they want. There are opportunities for even lower priced freezing of your body and recovery. And on the right there, I think what we're looking at in the upper right is someone who's chosen just to have their head frozen. Just to have their head frozen. So if you can believe that people are going to thaw you out, figure out how to cure you and get your whole body going, I guess it's not much of a leap in faith to figure out someone's also going to donate a perfectly good young body to reattach your head to or something, right? So that's cryonics. I guess I am going to talk a little bit more about biology. I'll jump around a little bit and get back to human history. But I did want to talk about the trees a bit before I do that. Trees and plants and soils, for that matter. So this is the furthest north spruce tree on the Alaska pipeline. You can see this if you drive up the Dalton Highway. You'll probably still see the sign. I think it's still there. Unfortunately, if you look closely at the figure, you can see that somebody went in there with a hatchet and they had to just girdle this tree and kill the tree. And of course, there's plenty more spruce trees further north. They're just not on the road, so it's maybe not as bad as it seems. But you know, people should kind of scratch their heads about what's going on with trees and why is it? Why do we have a tree line both in the northern latitudes and at altitude? Why do the forests disappear? And that's a very good question, and it's actually a very complicated answer with lots of different dimensions to it in different areas. I'd also say that we don't have the northernmost tree in the world in the United States. The northernmost tree in the world is the Dahorian larch tree that grows in northern Europe and North Korea and northern Russia. And we don't have those trees in this part of the world. But there's a sketch of those trees in the upper left. A tree we all know and love well, of course, is the black spruce. And this is a scene that we've all seen many times. And it's a dead giveaway, and most Alaskans know this. It's a dead giveaway. We see these trees leaning at all kinds of odd angles, and some people even call it a drunken forest. It's a dead giveaway that forest is growing on permafrost. And what do I mean by permafrost? Well, permafrost, the sort of technical definition of permafrost, is soil that remains in a frozen state for longer than 2 years. So soil that's permanently frozen. And what do we mean by that? Well, we mean by that if you take a soil core, you dig down into the soil very close to the surface, even in the middle of summer, you will come to a frozen layer in the soil. And that frozen layer can continue much, much further down. And that's what you can see in this core on the side here. And those are in centimeters, so 20 centimeters, 40 centimeters. At just before 60 centimeters, there's a frozen layer of water in this case. And permafrost isn't always frozen water. Sometimes it's dry soil, but that dry soil is frozen in the sense that it's below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's permafrost. There's another example of a kind of permafrost. It's a different kind than we see in the lower photograph. But again, you see this layer of ice. And that explains very well what's going on with these trees. There's not enough soil for these trees to reach down and get a good stronghold with their roots, and so they're leaning over a little bit. And if the permafrost layer is very, very close to the surface, like it is in the soil core on the bottom, you would not find trees. You would be too far north or too high up for trees to occur because there's just not enough rooting zone for those trees to hold on. So here's another thing for Alaskans, and this is something that not all Alaskans know about. It's the permafrost tunnel in Fairbanks. How many people know about the permafrost tunnel? About half of you. How many people have been in it? Everybody that knows about it, probably? No, only a couple people. Good. The permafrost tunnel is a tunnel that was dug, I think, in the 1970s into a hillside just outside of Fox, Alaska, which is just outside of Fairbanks. And it was dug to test tunneling gear and to test the opportunities to dig out hills of permafrost to use those for storage or other activities that at that time the military was interested in. Well, they pretty quickly figured out that if you dig these things and you put anything in them, they thought they start to thaw out very quickly. So they're not very good for structural use. But they left the permafrost tunnel intact. They put some doors on the permafrost tunnel, and they maintain it mainly for education of engineers and soil scientists. And for research. And you can go to the permafrost tunnel today if you know somebody that can get you in there, and you can look at permafrost and get sort of the worm's eye view of what permafrost looks like from inside the ground. So what I showed you earlier was the shallow permafrost, just a little bit below the surface of the ground. You run into permafrost. Well, in some parts of Alaska, that soil stays frozen down as deep as 1,800 feet. So the soil is frozen from very close to the surface all the way to 1,800 feet, and it's not frozen below 1,800 feet, of course, because the warmth of the earth is preventing the soil from staying frozen. But in Fairbanks, the most parts of Fairbanks anyway, the permafrost starts relatively deep, so you might have to go down 6 or 7 or 8 feet before you hit permafrost. But it continues to go down in places for hundreds of feet. And you can see that in the permafrost tunnel in Fox, Alaska. I'll also mention, and I think this is relatively unknown, we are in the process of here in Alaska of digging a new permafrost tunnel, or we're very close to starting digging a new permafrost tunnel. And in fact, some of the test diggings will probably be made in the next few weeks up in Fairbanks, right next to the existing tunnel, but with new technologies and with better funding to maintain the frozen condition of the tunnel. And if funding comes fully through, it'll be open, or at least more open, to public visitors. So here's another aspect of permafrost. This is up in the Alaskan Arctic, near the Beaufort Sea. And what we're looking at here, I'm looking out a helicopter window, or I might have been in an airplane and I took a snapshot. And what you're seeing is the ground surface, and this is called polygonized ground. And polygonized ground is very common in permafrost. And each of those shapes or polygons is about maybe 30 feet across. And in between those shapes where you see snow and ice, those are called ice wedges. And what's happening is that the ground is warming up in the summer and it's cooling off in the winter, or warming up and cooling off at day and night, or from day to day. And as it warms up and cools off, it expands and contracts. And when it contracts, it cracks, and a small crack forms, and those cracks form these polygonized networks. And when those cracks form, they fill up with water, and then when that water freezes, the water expands, and it pushes the crack a little bit wider. And each time it cracks and fills with water and refreezes, it gets a little bit wider. And over time, you get these ice wedges developing in here. And you can see the ice wedges that form the outline around each polygon. And if you could somehow magically make all that soil just disappear, so you just kind of wave your magic wand or spread some nasty, terrible chemical out there, make all the soil disappear but leave the ice behind, you would have this incredible honeycomb of ice wedges. And you can see these things. You can dig them up. They're not pure ice. There's some dirt in them, but they're fairly clean ice. They're clean enough for, at least for most Alaskans anyway, to put in a drink and drink the water without worrying about it too much. So those are ice wedges in a permafrost landscape. Some other things that ice does, of course, and we've all seen this around the mountains in Anchorage, ice has an incredibly incredible strength. So when ice forms, it has a remarkable strength of expansion. So those water molecules start to line up with one oxygen lining up with a hydrogen, and they form this structure, this crystal structure. And as they're lining up, unlike most things, as they cool, as water cools and freezes, it expands. And it expands with tremendous power and plenty of power to crack rocks. And we've all seen that happening before. We've all seen valleys like this one. And here's a beautiful ice-carved valley, or glacial-carved valley, that traditional U-shaped valley that you see throughout Alaska and throughout the northern part of the U.S., speaking to the fact that these glaciers were carved by rivers of ice, tremendous rivers of ice that might have been a mile deep in places. So that brings us to this man. This is Agassiz. And Agassiz, if you know your history, was back around in the late 1800s. And Agassiz's claim to fame is that he discovered or promoted the idea of ice ages. So nowadays we all sort of think, well, of course there were ice ages. We all say that of course there were ice ages. Every kid knows that. Woolly mammoths were wandering around, and it was the great ice ages, and it was very much colder than it is today. And New York City was under a half a mile of ice, or a mile of ice, and you can see the marks from that on the rocks in Central Park in New York City. And we all know that the lakes down around Michigan were carved out by blocks of ice, and et cetera, et cetera. It's common knowledge. But back in the 1800s, this was not common knowledge. People, in fact, took a lot of convincing of this in the late 1800s that this was going on, and Agassiz was the person who did this convincing. And Agassiz started out his professional career as kind of a fish biologist, and later on got interested in glaciers, in the glaciers of Europe, and started looking at those glaciers and thinking about them, and eventually gave this paper where, out of the blue, he kind of announced at a scientific meeting, he announced that the Earth was covered by a huge sheet which buried the Siberian mammoths and reached just as far south as did the phenomenon of erratic boulders. And of course, erratic boulders are these rocks that are carried by glaciers, and they're sitting out in the middle of a cornfield somewhere or something. There's a big rock sitting there, and you wonder how it got there. Well, it got there on a glacier many, many, many years before. So Agassiz promoted this idea, and for a long time people said, oh, you're crazy. And now, of course, we know that he's not crazy. In fact, he actually very much underestimated ice ages. There was more than one ice age. There were multiple ice ages during the Pleistocene period, at least five periods of significant glaciation. You can argue that we're still in an ice age today. It's a very easy argument to make. If you look at a picture of the Earth from space, you'll see a planet that has two poles with major areas that are frozen solid, winter and summer. You'll see an area in the northern hemisphere during the cold season that's frozen quite a way down, a third of the way down to the equator. So you look at that and you'd have to say, if you took a detached view rather than sort of our ground level view here as subjective humans, you would have to look at that planet and say, oh, that planet's in an ice age right now. It can and will get, if things continue going the way they are going, it can and will get much warmer, and of course it can and has been much warmer in the past as well. It's also been much colder. In fact, there was a scientist named Hoffman who recognized not too long ago, I think starting in the 1970s and 80s, Hoffman started to recognize that there had been a much earlier ice age about 700 million years ago when, if his data are correct, the entire Earth might have been frozen. So the entire surface of the Earth without liquid water present. There was liquid water under the ice, there's no doubt of that, but Hoffman argues that the Earth was in a frozen state, and he calls his theory sometimes Snowball Earth, and other people argue with him and say, no, you're not right, and people wrote articles with titles like, I think one title was A Snowball's Chance in Hell or something like that about the fact that Hoffman was wrong, and somebody else wrote another article that talked about Slushball Earth. It wasn't quite Snowball, it was Slushball Earth. But anyway, there have been multiple ice ages over millions and millions of years. There's also been lots and lots of very warm periods over millions and millions of years. And it seems like we're coming out of an ice age finally now and entering into a warmer period, perhaps with a little bit of help from ourselves. Here's another historical character, Frederick Tudor. And Frederick Tudor is not well known to most people. He was known at his time, though, back in the 1800s as the Ice King. And he was known as the Ice King. He lived in Boston. He was known as the Ice King because he made a tremendous fortune selling ice. And he would say things like this in his diary. He would say things like, the frost covers the windows, the wheels creak, the boys run, winter rules, and $50,000 worth of ice floats for me upon Fresh Pond. He also harvested ice from Walden Pond and lots of other places. And the way he made his money was like many people make their money, by starting out as a total crackpot. He would harvest ice, he would put the ice on ships, and he would send those ships south. And he went bankrupt several times doing this, went to debtor's prison back in the days of debtor's prison, went to debtor's prison on at least one occasion, and was on the way to debtor's prison when he finally got a successful shipment off. And the story is that he was one step ahead of the sheriff as he cast off from the dock with a load of ice, sailed down to the Caribbean, sold his ice. The people he was selling the ice to were, of course, amazed. Many of them had never seen ice in the Caribbean at that period of history. Some of them came back the next day very angry because you sold me this ice and now it's just water. They were very confused by that. So, but in the end, he made lots and lots and lots of money and became the equivalent of today of a billionaire, really, by selling ice. And he did all that, of course, with manual labor and ice saws, and he packed it into sailing ships, and he sold ice via sailing ship as far away as India. So he had a worldwide network selling ice that he would insulate in sawdust and hay and various things like that and ship it around the world. And I have to share also this quote from his diary. I love this quote, and I'll read it for you because his handwriting is probably almost as bad as mine. So he wrote, "He who gives back at the first repulse and without striking the second blow despairs of success has never been, is not, and never will be a hero in war, love, or business." So I like that saying. It basically says, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And for those of you who are interested in trying to be writers, truer words were never spoken. I suppose there's got to be other people. I know there's at least one other writer in the room, and I know there's probably others that are interested in writing and maybe have had some success at writing as well. Here's another historical character. This is Cornelius Drebbel. And Drebbel was a Dutchman. He was an alchemist. To the extent that he's known to history, he was known for having created what's usually acclaimed as the first submarine. And Drebbel, among other folks, he served under King James in England. And one of the things he did for King James was that he air conditioned, for a very short time, Westminster Abbey. And Westminster Abbey, of course, downtown London. And even today, it is not air conditioned. It's quite warm in the summer. So even today, it's not air conditioned. So how did he do it? We don't actually know how he did it, but we know he succeeded. We think what he probably did was he collected lots of vats of cold water out of the River Thames and buckets of snow and things like that from ice cellars, and he put it in the middle of Westminster Abbey, and he probably added saltpeter to set up a chemical reaction to make that snow even colder and the water even colder than it was through an endothermic reaction that pools in heat from the air. But we don't know because he was an alchemist and he didn't leave records. But just another one of the interesting characters from the annals of cold. And also, to some people, the person who started this pursuit of super cold temperatures. So remember, it wasn't too long ago that we didn't know how to build refrigerators. That was kind of a breakthrough in the 1800s and on into the 1900s. And we certainly didn't know how to get down to these very, very cold temperatures. And as we moved into the late 1800s and the late 1900s, that became a very exciting pursuit in physics and in science, was how do you get to the colder temperatures? And people knew that there was such a thing as absolute zero. They knew theoretically that there must be an absolute zero. And that was their target. And there is indeed an absolute zero. There's a temperature to which you can go no colder. And that is the temperature at which motion stops. So molecular motion stops. In fact, we know today, because of quantum theory, that you can't even reach absolute zero, but you can get very, very close to absolute zero. And along that journey, there were lots of scientists involved, and they were doing their science at a time when the polar regions were also being explored, the South Pole with Scott and various other people, in the North Pole with Parry and Cook and others. And they compared themselves. Some of them like to compare themselves to the Arctic explorers. The Arctic regions in physics and cite the experimenter as the extreme north and south and cite the discoverer. And you know, it's not entirely without truth what they were saying. Some of the experiments they did were very dangerous. Their laboratories were blowing up frequently. People were losing limbs. They were having glass blown into their eyes, and et cetera, et cetera. But they gradually got temperatures colder and colder and colder. And they started running into problems, though. They started running into temperatures that they couldn't get past. And it wasn't until the 1970s, 1980s, and even into the 1990s that we began to get very, very close to absolute zero, within a few billionths of a degree of absolute zero. And long, long ago, somebody predicted that when we got close to absolute zero, it would be the death of matter as we know it. It turns out that that is, in fact, true, that the matter that exists at temperatures very close to absolute zero does not behave like normal matter. It's not a liquid. It's not a gas. It's not a solid. It is a Bose-Einstein condensate, because two scientists, Bose, who most of you probably haven't heard of, and Albert Einstein, realized that at very low temperatures, quantum effects would kick in, and these Bose-Einstein condensates would form. And here's a photograph of a Bose-Einstein condensate glowing in the lower right. So it's actually the material right outside the Bose-Einstein condensate that glows. And the people that did this experiment won a Nobel Prize for it. And one of them, during a press release for his Nobel Prize, he cut the press release short because he had to run off and teach a class in sort of physics 101, physics for non-majors. And I thought that was fantastic that this incredible physicist who's being interviewed for winning the Nobel Prize was humble enough and mild-mannered enough that he said, guys, I have to go because I have a bunch of undergraduate students waiting to learn about physics, so I need to go do my job. I thought that was fantastic. He also said that this was the coldest place in the universe, unless by chance there was a lab similar to his somewhere else in the universe where somebody was doing a similar experiment. The point being that those temperatures don't exist in the natural universe. I can't do a talk about cold, of course, without saying something about climate change and about global warming. So I wanted to share this slide with you, and I think most of us have seen some form of this at some time or another. This is a picture of the Earth looking down from above. So we're looking down on the North Pole, and if you look off to the left there, you can see Alaska, kind of a different map than we're used to seeing for the most part. It's called a polar projection, and we're looking down on the pole. And you can see a red line, and that red line represents the normal extent of the sea ice in September over the last roughly 20 years. And the white that you see there, of course, is the sea ice that existed the year that this image was made, which from memory was 2007 or maybe 2008. But the point is that the ice cap at that time was much smaller. This is a summertime ice cap, remember, was much smaller than it normally should be. And that's one of the things that seems to be going on with climate change. And I sometimes talk to people about this, and people have lots of opinions about climate change. But one opinion that people have about climate change that's completely wrong and just historically incorrect is that it's a new idea. You know, too often I hear people say climate change is just something dreamed up by these greenies and these white suits at universities trying to figure out ways to raise money. Aspects of that may or may not be true, I don't know. But the fact is that it's a very old idea. Fourier was the first person to recognize that the Earth's atmosphere made the Earth warmer than it otherwise should be. He recognized greenhouse effect. If you remove the Earth from the Earth's atmosphere and you just had the Earth sitting out here at this distance from the sun, it would be much, much colder than it is, and that's because of the Earth's atmosphere. So the Earth's atmosphere acts to trap heat, essentially. And that's what people believe is going on now, is that we've changed, or some people believe that we've changed the Earth's atmosphere enough in order to increase the temperature. And that's a very basic piece of physics. If you add lots of carbon dioxide, lots of water vapor, lots of methane to a gas, it will hold heat, it will trap heat more effectively than it would otherwise do. So very simple physics. The key, though, is all else being equal, right? So all else being equal, if you add lots of carbon dioxide and methane, don't change anything else, you would certainly expect the temperature to go up. But was the temperature going up anyway because of other things, because maybe the sun's getting a little bit warmer or something else is going on? Are other things changing in the Earth? Who knows? You know, it's pretty clear that the past 10 years or so, we've certainly seen some warming trends around the Earth. But that's not new. Here's another historical figure. This is Guy Callender. Guy Callender was a steam engineer by profession. But back in the early 1900s, Guy Callender was tracking temperatures as best as he could do at that time. And he and many other people recognized that there seemed to be a warming trend. And it was a very active topic of conversation back in those days. In fact, most people at that time welcomed the warming trend because they thought it would be good for crops and good for moving up into northern regions and that kind of thing. And you'll still hear people say that sort of thing today, right? Alaskans for global warming and all that. But Guy Callender recognized this back then. He was criticized, of course, because the temperature data weren't that good. And ultimately, he sort of fell off the map. And why did he fall off the map? Because it started to cool off again. So we had this warming trend back in the early 1900s, and then it started to get cooler. And then along comes this guy, Roger Revelle, working. He's an oceanographer, a chemical oceanographer, who was working in the 60s and on into the 70s. And Revelle looked at all this carbon dioxide that was going into the atmosphere, and he said, we have a problem here, folks. And prior to Revelle, people had sort of dismissed this idea that all the carbon dioxide coming out from industry was a problem, because they said, no issue here at all. That carbon dioxide will dissolve in the oceans, and the oceans will absorb that carbon dioxide, and we'll all be fine. Let's keep burning fossil fuels and et cetera. And Roger Revelle pointed out that the oceans would indeed absorb a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide over time, but the carbon dioxide, at least in the very rapid period of dissolving gas out of the atmosphere, would be in the surface of the oceans, and it would take a long time for the full volume of the ocean to come into play. And he recognized that there was this rate problem with how quickly the carbon dioxide would evaporate out of the air. And he also recognized some other problems with this idea that the oceans would take care of all of our problems. And then climate change began to be an environmental issue, and of course is probably the foremost environmental issue that we talk about today. And there's lots of data sets out there, and the data sets say different things, but all of the data say that the multi-year ice in the Arctic in the summer is shrinking. There's no question that that's going on. It's hard to know exactly what's happening because most of these data come from satellites, and the satellites aren't necessarily all that good about getting around all the problems with judging ice thickness. But it is absolutely a fact that the amount of multi-year ice in the Arctic in the summer is greatly diminished than it was in the past. In the past that we have a record for over the last 20 or 30 years. What was it like back in Guy Callender's time? We really don't know. Who knows? What was it like 500 years ago, 2,000 years ago? We can speculate on details that happen, you know, year-to-year changes, decade-to-decade changes. We know a lot more about longer trends. But we do know that in the last 20 years, the sea ice has shrunk considerably in the summer. And that's it. That's what I wanted to share with you tonight. But I would like to open the floor to questions or to comments if people have their own stories to tell about cold. I love to hear cold stories from other people, especially Alaskans.
You've been listening to Bill Strever, author of Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places, on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. As part of the Author Talk series at the Anchorage Museum, Bill Strever's talk on all things cold a celebration of low temperatures, was recorded on November 11, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.